It's 8:18. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, Park City's Trailside Elementary School is using a teacher training program called Welcoming Schools. It's caused some controversy by a group of parents in the district who are concerned that the training infringes on their rights as parents to teach their young children family values and that the class of LGBTQ people should not have special treatment under the school's anti-bullying policies. In the studio, I have a parent who is concerned how the State Board of Education could be changing those rules that deal with anti-bullying protections, specifically for LGBTQ students in Utah schools. On the phone with me, I have Richard Osler. He has developed a Love is Love campaign, that after spending some time as an LDS church leader for a singles ward. I want to welcome both of you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
Michelle, why don't you just start by telling us a little bit about your involvement in this issue?
Let's see. I'm fairly new to Utah. My kids are in public schools for the second year now. I saw a note on the Nextdoor app about the State Education Board's proposed rules changes. They were discussed at the board's January meeting. And the proposed rules were summarized by a Park City resident who was concerned about them, and I read it and thought, that does not sound good. And her summary included, I'll just read it, three eliminations to the existing rule, which has been in place for a few years. The elimination from the rule of the term civil rights violations from the definition of bullying. Change number two would eliminate professional training content specifics, including topics of race and gender. So that specific language sounds quite targeted to vulnerable groups. And then the third change that was proposed at the January meeting was eliminating reporting detail requirements. So I contacted the woman who had posted that, and we reached out to the State Board of Education, and we've gotten different responses from different board members, listen to minutes from their meeting. And just to try to explain it in an overarching way, the board has said officially that these changes are not going to weaken bullying rules, that they want to break the existing rule into two parts. So yes, they want to take all this language out, but they say that they're going to put it in a different rule that's going to live somewhere else. So they say that they're planning to do that during their law and licensing committee meeting next week. So as a parent of an LGBTQ kid and just someone who does not want to see anything go backwards on this, I just read a little bit about the state board because, again, I'm new to the state, and I saw that in 2016 they were sued by Equality Utah because they refused to take a rule off their books that prohibited discussion of homosexuality in schools. So given that the Supreme Court affirmed gay marriage in 2015, the idea that a year later the state board was actively insisting on policy that would forbid any discussion of LGBTQ families seemed sort of problematic, to say the least. So I'm sure some people might know that Equality Utah sued them and won in 2017. And then that rule came off the books. And then schools were able to talk about LGBTQ students, families. You know, an LGBTQ teacher can have a picture of a same-sex spouse on his desk if he wants. And so that seems in keeping with federal civil rights decisions now. And so the proposed change just looked very sketchy. And it, you know, the recent history gave me pause. And I thought, well, we need to make sure that this is not going to weaken protections for vulnerable groups.
So my understanding is that it's one state school board member, Scott Hansen, who apparently is an attorney, is the one that wanted to tinker with this rule to make it, as he put it, I think, more clear. I mean, what's your understanding?
Yes, he authored the changes. He's a lawyer. I've heard he has no education background whatsoever, has never done anything inside a classroom. I don't know him. I've written to him many times over the last couple of weeks. He has not replied. Other board members have. I can't speak for him. I'm not inside his head. I don't know him. I haven't gotten his response. But I think that in talking to other people who have more history in the state, more familiarity than me, it just sounds a little bit like not everybody likes protecting these groups with specific language. And I think we're all familiar with the position among some of let's protect everybody. They don't need special protection.
Yeah. I want to get back to that in a little bit, but just are there outside groups that we know of, perhaps the Pacific Justice Institute, involved in any of these rule changes, proposed rule changes?
Well, that's the question that I brought to the board members in my emails to them, because the minutes from their meetings and from the state legislature meetings include representatives from the Pacific Justice Institute dialing in. Now, I wasn't there in the room, but Pacific Justice Institute is well known for lobbying in states that they think they can get a toehold, even though they have nothing to do with Utah. You know, they're not here, but they want to call in and they do pro bono work. And my understanding is that the Pacific Justice Institute is the organization that wrote the cease and desist letter to the Trailside Elementary School principal or staff because of the objection to the Welcoming Schools program, which I'm not going to say that caused this because I think they were happening concurrently. But as everybody knows, Welcoming Schools had a couple of people upset. We don't know the exact number because they complained anonymously, but they sent emails around to the Trailside community saying that that a LGBT inclusive anti-bullying teacher training program was sex education. And, you know, that's just a sad ideological disagreement. I mean, I would say that telling kids that women marry women and men marry men is no more sex education than talking about heterosexual marriage. It's just talking about families and their composition.
Richard Osler, let's bring you into this conversation. What's your background and how are you involved in this issue here?
Thanks, Leslie, and thanks, Michelle. So my name is Richard Osler. I live in Salt Lake City. I'm the married father of six children. I'm a former bishop in the LDS Church. I've been a PTA president for 2 years in our local high school, and I just started as part of my church assignment to meet LGBTQ people and recognize that they have a much harder road in our society. So I came to the point after meeting with people that we need to do everything we can in society, in our church communities, in our schools, to reach out to those that have the hardest road and use, in this case, legislation to protect them. I want my kids who are now out of the school to be, even though they're straight, to have these kind of laws in place to teach them how to interact with other people in a positive way. So, yeah, I care about the LGBTQ children in our school system, but I also care about the straight kids that need to learn how to treat other people that are most marginalized, and it helps them. It helps our community come together. I don't think talking about LGBTQ people makes people LGBTQ. I think there's a lot of fear out there that if we talk about this or normalize the existence of LGBTQ people, that our straight kids are going to become LGBTQ, and I just think that's fear. No one would ever, in my opinion, choose to become LGBTQ. It's the most difficult road in our society. Everybody I know that's LGBTQ would love to be straight. It's a brutal road. So I just love the idea of what Michelle's doing and what other thoughtful people are doing to use legislation to help us improve the experience in our schools for everybody. I think we all agree of a goal that schools should be safe for everybody, and we need to reach out to those that have the hardest road and do things to make sure that they're safe.
Do we know if the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has taken a position on these proposed rule changes? I mean, I know they say that they like to stay out of politics, but we know that's really not the case. I mean, if they want to weigh in, they'll weigh in.
Good question, Leslie. And I'm not here as a spokesperson for the LDS Church. I'm an active member of the church, but I don't know the answer to that. I would, you know, on the path, I just don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, and I think you kind of answered it already. But I mean, do public schools, should they take a role in protecting this class of people? I mean, do they need special protection?
I mean, my feeling is I didn't realize they did until if I just talked to the straight kids at high school, I would say no. Or if I just talked to the parents of straight kids, I would say everything's fine. But if you actually step in the space of talking to parents with LGBTQ kids or the LGBTQ kids themselves and sort of be willing to learn and set aside prior opinions, then my answer is yes. It's a brutal road. Our Utah statistics show higher suicide rates for LGBTQ youth, and so we need to do everything we can. These are wonderful, I come from a religious perspective, children of Heavenly Father who loves them, and we have a responsibility to help them feel like they belong and help them feel like who they are is a needed part of our community and a needed diversity to help us grow together as a common human people. So, yeah, but I call it the trap of unearned opinions. I had a lot of opinions about groups of people, but I learned to set those aside and not develop opinions until I meet with the very people I'm trying to develop opinions about.
Yeah, and the LDS leadership, I mean, I think they have kind of softened their position on memberships of their LGBTQ members, or no?
Yeah, I mean, I think I kind of call it a 40-chapter book, Leslie, is that I'd say the church's relationship with its LGBTQ members is like a 40-chapter book, and we continue to write new chapters as just we're better understanding how to meet the needs of this group of people. So we've, you know, we used to talk about sexual orientation, you could change that, and now the church's official presents is you can't. It's like being left-handed or blue-eyed or red hair. There's nothing I can do to change that, and we shouldn't impose that on other people, but instead recognize this as part of who they are, and we need to embrace that part of them. And they need to be at peace with this part of them, that this is who they are, and they're not a mistake. This is who they are. And so I think the church, that's an example where the church has moved past an earlier chapter to a current chapter.
Yeah. Are you alone on this?
Is that for Richard or Michelle?
That's, well, you. Just given that, yeah, just yeah, given that kind of the church's teachings on this.
No, there's a group of really thoughtful active LDS people that have felt impressed to step in this space. I started an organization called listenlearnandlove.org, and it has a mission statement that's supportive of the church, but also supportive of LGBTQ people. And I'm trying, as well as many others, to say this is not an either-or. You can do both. You don't have to sell out anything in your faith to love and support LGBTQ people. In fact, I believe it's the doctrine of my faith. It's the example of Christ, somebody I believe in, that reached out to the most marginalized and did everything he could to help them feel like they belong and were included and worthy of his companionship. So I'm not speaking for the church or part of the church, but there's a lot of thoughtful active LDS people. We have an advisory board on that website, or active LDS people, that support our mission statement and support just doing better in this space. We're not out after the church asking him to change doctrine. We're not advocating, you know, we just leave that to the leaders of our church, but we do believe that we can do better within our current doctrine, so to speak, to reach out and help people that are most marginalized. And that's why an issue like Michelle's working on, who's bravely stepping the space as a new parent in our community and a mother of a LGBTQ child, we love the work that Michelle is doing to try to help us do better as a community. We sometimes really do well as a community. Conversion therapy was, you know, that, I don't know what the right verb is, banned, outlawed, or put aside because of people coming together, recognizing through education, understanding this is something we need to move on in our society.
Michelle, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment about your last question to Richard, asking if this is something that schools should be doing for kids. I mean, clearly, Richard and I and many other people unequivocally believe, yes, we need to do this to create healthy learning environments for them. But I wanted to raise another point, which is that the protections in the state board's rules are also tools for teachers to help kids, but also to protect themselves. Teachers need to be able to address the reality of what's happening in their classrooms and what's happening in society without fear of being fired. Now, before the lawsuit that resulted in the No Promo Homo law coming off the books 3 years ago, I've heard from people who have been here longer than me that teachers lived in fear of losing their jobs for saying the wrong word, using the wrong terminology, answering a question too directly. They could hardly function sometimes in relation specifically to some of these issues.
And some of the local opponents that we've heard from of welcoming schools suggesting that the protections that we're providing with this class also means acceptance. And they've told us that the role of parents is being compromised and infringed on. And they say that elementary school students should not be exposed to LGBTQ. I mean, I'm guessing you take exception to that. You're saying it's reality.
Yeah, I mean, it's legal. And so I do consider a parent who wants to hide the existence of LGBTQ people from their child, I consider that to be somewhat of a fringe view. And I would say that I just don't see how the public school environment is the right place for that family. Because, for example, at Treasure Mountain Junior High, where my son was a ninth grader last year, they have an all-gender bathroom. The majority of his teachers were LGBTQ, as was the principal, as were many students. There's a Gay Straight Alliance student club with dozens of kids in it. I mean, you cannot hide this any more than you can hide gravity, as far as I'm concerned, when you're in the public sphere. So I mean no disrespect, but I don't see how someone with a religious doctrine that would forbid acknowledging other humans, I don't see how they could go through a government-funded school.
Okay. I've got to wrap it up. Either of you have anything else you want to say about this? I guess we're just going to watch and see what happens at next month's or next week's meeting.
Yeah, just I could tell you that next steps are the State Board's Law and Licensing Committee meeting is February 7th. The public can go comment there. You're supposed to email Secretary Lorraine Austin ahead of time and get on their docket. Otherwise, I would suggest that people who feel strongly about this email the board members and let them know your thoughts on the importance of anti-bullying rules that protect people.
Okay. Michelle Dengner and Richard Osler, I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
You bet. Thanks, Leslie.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:35. Hi. Well, the Park City Council meets tomorrow to discuss employee compensation, the Arts and Culture District, and more. Joining me with a preview, I have Park City Manager Matt Dias, along with Arts and Culture District Project Manager David Everett. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Matt, let's start with you first with regard to the council approving earlier a $130,000 contract with the human resources firm Mercer. The city's moving ahead with its employee compensation analysis. Are we sure the answer isn't as simple as pay them more?
Well, it might be. I would tend to think that it's a lot more complicated than that, as we both know, particularly with the growth of the Wasatch Front and the sort of additional professionalism of cities and towns on the Wasatch back. It's becoming increasingly harder to recruit and retain employees, and so this is something that council supported, and Mercer is technically working for city council now, so they're coming in to share with council their project plan, their timeline, and their methodologies.
So how are they going about the analysis? Who are they comparing Park City with?
All sorts of entities and jurisdictions, and they'll be dipping into the private sector too. So we have a lot of jobs because of our complex organization that are very comparable in the private sector, whether it's building maintenance, whether it's transit and transportation, or building officials. And so they'll be using public sector and private sector methodologies.
Additionally, the city's convened a Blue Ribbon Commission of locals to review Mercer's recommendations. Why is it important to have that input?
Well, we've done this before, and it was really successful.
With what?
When I started here maybe 7 years ago, we were reviewing city council and mayoral compensation. And at that time, there was a suggestion that we should sort of have a third-party objective lens to review the kind of facts and findings concurrently. And so We've made a foray here into having a third party of five individuals that would be reviewing the work of Mercer, the methodologies, looking at the reports that they're producing, the compensation of different jurisdictions and different types of job classifications, and then sharing with City Council their thoughts on those. So sort of a concurrent review, third party.
All right. Council will also be revisiting the Historic District Grant Program, which is intended to incentivize and offset the cost of historic preservation for residential and commercial structures. Can you tell us what staff's recommending with this?
So staff's recommending that we revise our Historic District Grant Program. And it's a very detailed, very thorough report. And the planners in our organization really do a very, very good job of writing, kind of very concise, clear staff reports. So if the public is interested, I encourage them to review this, particularly if they're living in areas where there's historic properties. In the past, the program has been more focused on larger properties, and they have been constrained in terms of what types of granting the funds could be used for. So some of the definitions, some of the criteria will be expanded, some of the regulatory burdens will be eliminated. And we're going to actually recommend that we take out what was always sort of a local preference or a full-time resident preference. I think that over time, as the grants have been used, we've sort of eaten up that capacity, and preservation is the real goal. And irrespective of who lives there, if it's a second homeowner or a primary homeowner, the planners are really, really interested in the historic character and preserving that.
So are we talking about beefing it up with more money too?
Perhaps. That will be a council policy decision.
The 2020 general session of the Utah Legislature started Monday. You'll be presenting the city's legislative platform to council. What does that look like?
Well, we were there actually on the first day. We had our 40 or so, some odd members of our leadership class and several city council members, and it was a good and busy opening day. Obviously, where they immediately went after repealing the tax bill that was enacted, but. In just very simple terms, there's not a day goes by that during the 45-day session we're asked to comment on a bill, support a bill, weigh in on a piece of legislation, and we can't possibly get back to council and make sure that we're getting council blessing to just activate a lobbyist or to weigh in on an issue between council meetings. And so we took a step back and we made a policy document, a guiding document. And it's pretty simple. It's no unfunded mandates, protect our revenues, make sure that local representation and local control are preserved at all times. But it enables people like myself, it enables city council members and the mayor to work with the legislature and still conform to an underlying principles of city council.
So we can trust you to represent us?
Well, you're gonna,
we didn't elect you.
You're going to have to. And, I have been doing it for 6 or 7 years, and I've got a lot of experience prior to coming to Park City. But I'll say where I'm tethered is this bond or this contract that we have with City Council, where we have an underlying policy document. I have to stay within those guardrails, and they do too. And this is their compact with each other and with the community. And I think the nice part is that every week we come in and we provide a legislative report to summarize what was done in the week, any activities that were taken, and at any time, City Council can update their policy document.
The city also pays for a lobbyist, so how is that role different from yours or Mayor Andy Bierman's when interacting with lawmakers?
Fair question. The real difference is our lobbyist lives at the Capitol. And this is their primary function. They're there every single day, day in and day out, and has much deeper and closer contacts with the legislators than we do. So when we need to have a meeting with the legislature, when a particular senator or House representative has questions for us, helping us testify, prepare testimony, prepare talking points, it's been a great resource for us. And we've, for the better part of, I'd say, almost 20 years, we've worked with several different lobbyists at the Capitol.
White Pine Touring has operated Nordic Skiing on the Park City Golf Course and the McPullen Farm area for years. Council's considering changes to that program, changing fees to favor locals and then adding trails to the Armstrong Snow Ranch pastures that we purchase as open space. Can you talk a little bit about that tiered fee system proposal?
Yeah, I mean, to take a step back, as you said, for about 30 years, we've had different sort of cross-country services out there, and council desired to initiate a policy discussion. We have the new open space of the Armstrong property that we can be inclusive of. There are some nice maps in the stat report if people in the community are interested for the first time. On holes 5 and 6, we'll be sort of suggesting that we can go on the other side of the fence, closer to the actual barn and up on the hillside. And it should be a really, really interesting component for individuals to kind of activate and experience that open space that they bought. But to take a step back, we wanted to initiate this policy conversation, wanted to know if there was any preference given to locals, maybe over other people from outside the community that are seeking to use it. And then particularly about the barn, I think that there were some questions that maybe a different function or a different schematic altogether than the actual golf course. It's an open space property, and maybe that's a no-fee area. So we really just wanted to initiate a policy conversation.
Okay. So is that, we're just starting? We haven't figured anything out? We're looking at next season, is that?
Yeah, we'll be looking at next season, and we're doing it early. And we came in last year. We did a new one-year lease with Jans, who's the concessionaire. And we've been incredibly happy with the services that they provide and the quality of the trails over there, some of the best in our community.
David Everett, you are the project manager for the Arts and Culture District. But just a clarification, I had thought that this was Nate Rockwood's project. I thought he was project manager.
Well, I'll take that, David, if you don't mind. I'll interrupt you before you get started. But so, yes, we're pleased to introduce David Everett, who's our kind of new project manager of the Arts and Culture District. And the reason for that is that Nate's actually accepted a position in a different community. So sort of heart-sick news that Nate's going to be leaving us. He's going to become the community development director down in Midvale. And it's a wonderful opportunity for Nate. He's someone who's spent over 12 years with Park City Municipal, very, very well respected. And even myself and council, personally, we've worked with him incredibly closely on the financing of many of these big open space acquisitions. So heartfelt, heart sick that we're losing Nate, but it's just a wonderful opportunity for him and his family. But then concurrently, we're really fortunate to bring in David Everett, and I'll let David introduce himself. But David was Ralph Becker's chief of staff for the better part of 10 years and was involved in the Eccles Center project where, as you know, you have Salt Lake County, Salt Lake City, and private landowners working on creating kind of a vibrant arts and culture area. And so we thought the nexus there was really, really positive. And I think that's one of the reasons that Nate is willing to take this other opportunity, that he does feel like we have it in good hands.
Okay, so you are on a contract basis then, not a...
Correct.
Full-time.
For now, it's working as a contractor on behalf of the city, and I'm working closely with, obviously, with Matt and with Nate right now to really download and get my arms around the project. But I really see my role as primarily coordinating staff internally, making sure the data and communication is happening externally, both with council members and with, obviously, key stakeholders, and then making sure what we're communicating with the public is meeting the goals of the council moving forward.
The city hired an advisor last summer, Rob Wolf, to help guide the vision for all of this. Haven't heard much from him. Are you working closely with him?
Yes, we're Rob Wolf's first contract ended, and we're working on figuring out the best way to deploy him moving forward, for sure. He's been a great resource for the city, it sounds like, and for the community. So we're trying to figure out the best way to capitalize on his skills moving forward.
You're bringing a $338,000 change order with the district's architects for council approval. A big chunk of that is for scoping the feasibility of a pedestrian bridge. What are we talking about here?
Right. So a big chunk of what we're talking about in that change order is looking at design and feasibility for a strong pedestrian connection between the Arts and Culture District over to the Prospector side of Bonanza. That's a very underutilized pedestrian corridor on the Prospector side, and how can the Arts and Culture District being there best activate and connect to that side of the road?
Well, because the road narrows so much that you basically lose a sidewalk. I mean, I can tell you all about that.
Yeah.
It's a dangerous intersection for pedestrians.
Precisely. There's a major safety concern there. We want to if we can get rid of that safety concern by creating an overhead connection, one that's aesthetically pleasing, that makes sense in the district, that really probably could potentially become an iconic feature and welcome people to the district visually as well as physically, then I think that, you know, that's a primary goal there.
So were we talking about the location at Prospector Avenue there?
Yes, it's right in that area. The location exactly hasn't been set. The alignment's not been set. The discussions are going to be happening very quickly here, presuming that the council, if the council approves this, to figure all that out, because we need to get that dialed in pretty quickly as we move toward a more public phase of this project.
So where are we in the process of developing this district?
So a lot of work has been done very quietly, as you would probably say at this point, moving up to this point. However, coming up soon, we're going to really be getting into a major public process piece of this as the partners all come together, agree on what the preliminary design and organization of the site looks like. Once that's done, then we can really start to roll it out to the public to get public feedback on that. And that's through the city's MPD process that is required to go, that we're obviously all required to go through.
Okay, so when would we expect to see something back with some preliminary master plan?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I give you a date, I'll be wrong. What's that happen? But no, I think it could be, gosh, as late as the end of February, but hopefully this winter and no later than early spring. We're obviously working with two longtime community stakeholders that have a lot to gain, and in Kimball Arts Center and the Sunzan Institute. And so we want to do it well. And to David's point, we're a little behind just the project scoping and scalability and dealing with water tables and soil testing and preliminary engineering and analysis. I'm reminded from our friends in the development community when I'm walking around town that kind of, give me a little elbow and say, see, it's harder than you thought. This takes real time, real work, and real money to deliver a quality project. And for us to have a local arts and culture district that's community-based and community-driven and has all sorts of residential components and small business components, we're trying to do it right. But so that's why we're coming in with this change order. We have noticed here that, we do seek better connectivity to resolve some of the disconnects in this area, particularly for pedestrians and bicyclists and other individuals that are trying to get across this roadway. And the last thing we want is a major thoroughfare bisecting or, dissecting two business districts.
Yeah, so the Homestake parking lot is full, and it has been during Sundance. We kind of brought it back for Sundance special events. That's a separate project. Is that going away, though, after this Sundance?
Long term, I think the plan is that we will have a park and ride out by Highway 248 and Highway 40. So even earlier on in the process, we'll be able to get people out of their cars and move them into the transit system.
Yeah, that's great for people living outside the city limits, but for those living within the city limits means more miles on the road.
I'm not sure. I guess for people
moving.
You have
to drive out of town to get into town to come to Main Street.
For people that are outside, yes, that's correct. Right.
Real quick, the February 5th joint transit meeting, has that been rescheduled to when?
It hasn't. We don't have a date certain yet. We'll be speaking to our city council about it tonight. We have a few dates on the calendar, but unfortunately it was delayed. I think that a member of the Summit County Council, Chris Robinson, wasn't able to be there, and he's going to be the new JTAB representative. And so I'll be sharing that information with our city council tonight. And as soon as we have a new date, we'll make sure we bring that to you and the public.
All right, Matt Dias, David Everett, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks. Thank
you. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 8:51. Well, it seems like a week doesn't go by that the sheriff's rap sheet shows someone else getting scammed. And the latest scam seemed to be coming from the sheriff's department itself. In the studio with recommendations on what to do or probably what not to do when you find yourself caught up in something like this, I have Sheriff's Lieutenant Andrew Wright. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you are going through to businesses in the county passing out flyers. Why?
We are seeing more and more people receiving these phone calls from scammers. And the way it works, they're basically posing as a law enforcement agent, FBI agent, government agent, IRS, doesn't matter. Recently, we had someone pose as a investment scheme fraudster. So what they're doing, they're calling people. Specifically, recently, we had people call using our phone number as the caller ID, and posing as a couple of our lieutenants, actual employees of the sheriff's office. I assume they probably went on our website and got those names. Basically, what they're doing, they're telling people that they have a warrant for their arrest, they missed jury duty, and that they need to pay a fine in order to avoid arrest. They're asking these people to go to a local retail store and purchase a gift card. That should be your very first red flag. No one is going to accept payment for a fine using a gift card. We don't call and take payment over the phone for any kind of a fine. That always goes through the courts. You have to go in person. Sometimes they'll do it over the phone if you call into them. But that should be your first red flag. They're keeping these people on the phone as they go into the retail store getting these gift cards. they're asking them to read off that gift card number and the PIN number, and that money is gone immediately.
Yeah. So the suspects, as you mentioned, are in some cases using the name of local officers, actual phone numbers, as you mentioned, and also reading off badge numbers. So they do sound authentic. But I guess what you could also do is stop them right there and say, I'm going to call the sheriff's office and just verify this.
Yeah, absolutely. If you ever question, and you should question nowadays, a phone call coming in demanding payment for, even if it's a utility bill that you're behind on, that they're claiming that you're behind on, don't give them any information. Don't give them account numbers. Don't give them bank information. Don't give them your social security number. Hang up, call the official number from the website and verify that that is in fact what is going on. I guarantee you, majority of the time, that is not the case. It can save you a lot of heartache and it can save you a lot of money.
Yeah. So are you ever able to help these people?
Mostly no. We are finding that the majority of these phone calls are coming from outside of the country. However, a couple weeks ago, we took a case where someone was attempting to buy some, I believe it was tires, off of KSL. They had correspondence with someone. Actually, they were selling the tires. Anyway, someone said, I'll send you this money via a check, cashier's check, which happened to be fraudulent. It's over the amount that they're asking for the product. They're saying, cash it. The money is for someone that I'm going to send to pick up that product. And it ended up being a scam. That person called us. Our deputy was quick to trace this down. We located that this was coming out of the Midwest here in the country. And we were actually able to get that money back. Great success story. We don't see that often. So always be skeptical when people are calling you. And it sounds too good to be true, or if they're demanding payment over the phone, especially with gift cards. So yes, we've been going into our local retail stores, asking them to put up this sign that's basically says, beware of scammers. Are you being scammed? And we are listing these types of scenarios that we've seen so far of people receiving these phone calls and losing tens of thousands of dollars in our community to these scammers. We want to prevent our community members from being scammed.
Yeah. And I guess just informing or educating the employees as well about things like this happening. I mean, they should be maybe a little bit more on their toes, just saying, why are you buying all of these gift cards or something? Or is that any of their business?
As I've gone into some of these retail stores, I've talked to the managers themselves. Several of them told me they are doing things like notifying their employees to strike up a conversation with that customer and basically say, did you know there's scams going on? We want to take it one step further at the sheriff's office and actually try to get into these team meetings within these retail stores and do a little instructional kind of an FYI. How can you engage with the customer and show that you're partnering with local law enforcement to protect them from losing thousands of dollars?
So you're asking the businesses then to kind of put up this flyer that you've prepared and in places where the gift cards are being sold?
Yeah. So we are asking them to hang these at their gift card centers. Typically, if you go into a retail store, you'll see that they have a large section of gift cards. We're asking them to hang them there. Oftentimes, we have to jump the hurdle of corporate to do these types of things. But at minimum, we're trying to make contact and partner with our local businesses to help protect our community.
All right. And how does somebody get the sheriff's department phone number to show up on caller ID?
You know, there are apps available. You can use a Google Voice. There's different apps available that you can actually basically show whatever number you want that you're calling from. It's actually pretty easy. And that's why it's so scary as these people are using real names, real phone numbers in our community. And oftentimes these messages can sound automated. So it does to the general person sound legitimate. It can sound like it really is coming from us, but we want to warn the public, be on your toes. Don't give money or personal information. When in doubt, hang up, call your local law enforcement and let us help you save that heartache and that loss of money.
Okay, that non-emergency line, 435-615-3601. Hey, I just want to ask you real quick, the investigation ongoing then for the Wasatch County School District employee who was booked into jail. And she's the Summit County is investigating this because it happened within Summit County?
Correct. She was a Wasatch County School District employee. The students involved were also students down in the Wasatch County School District. However, because the crime took place here in Summit County, we are the investigating agency, and ultimately we are the ones that did arrest her.
Okay. All right. Hey, anything else you wanted to mention?
I don't think so. We appreciate everyone's support. Just help us help you, prevent a lot of heartache and a loss of money.
Okay. Sheriff's Lieutenant Andrew Wright, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.